It is Monday, November 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, French President François Hollande says his country is at war with the Islamic State as police conduct raids across the country and French jets launch airstrikes in Syria against militants. And a new television series explores what would have happened if the Axis powers had won World War II. It's all ahead. French President François Hollande today called for a united front to defeat the Islamic State following the Friday attacks that killed at least 129 people. He spoke before a joint session of the French Parliament.
France is at war. The acts committed on Friday evening in Paris and near the National Stadium are acts of war. They caused no less than 129 dead and many injured. It is an aggression against our country, against its values, against its youth, against its way of life.
Mr. Hollande called on the U.S. and Russia to join forces to defeat IS. French authorities have detained 23 people in police raids across the country in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks, as authorities say they have identified the suspected mastermind behind the deadly assault. A Belgian national of Moroccan descent, Abdelhamid Aboud, was named as the possible lead plotter of the attacks. I spoke with reporter Lisa Bryant in Paris. I know you've been conducting some interviews today in Paris. Who have you been speaking with, and what have they been telling you?
Well, I went down to the Place de la République, where, as and elsewhere in France, a lot of people gathered to hold a minute of silence in honor of the victims of Friday's attacks. I talked to all kinds of people, but I especially talked to French Muslims, and you know, some of them have had friends, relatives who have died in the attacks. They feel worried that they might be stigmatized. There have been, you know, anti-Muslim attacks, a real spike in them since the first set of terrorist attacks in Paris in January. In fact, there's something called the National Observatory Against Islamophobia, and according to them, they're part of a French Muslim council. According to them, there's been a 200% increase in anti-Muslim sort of hate crimes over the first three quarters of this year. So people are afraid. People are also feeling a lot of solidarity, and they say, you know, I'm Muslim, but I'm also French. These terrorists have nothing to do with our faith. So that was one sentiment. And then just a larger sentiment of real sorrow, somewhat of fear, and also sort of defiance that the terrorists are not going to crush sort of the French spirit.
Did any of the people you spoke to talk at all about the refugee situation? I mean, about potential refugees coming in from Syria, because I believe one of the attackers, at least one of them, had links to Syria or had a Syrian passport.
Yeah, I mean, the question about the passport, my understanding is that there are a lot of false passports, so it's really hard to say. It wasn't particularly the subject of conversation today. A lot of people just wanted to talk about their grief. However, it is a concern. Obviously, I mean, France has said that it would be welcoming in more than 20,000 refugees over the next 2 years. François Hollande said that after, you know, of course, the huge wave of refugees that started to arrive. So, yes, that is a lingering concern. I'm sure it's going to raise its head. It was going to be an issue for elections, local elections, regional elections are coming up in December. You know, it's going to be an issue for the far right. I think the first reaction is sort of grief still right now, but certainly questions about, you know, whether France should close its door. It's already part of the debate, and it's going to be surfacing probably increasingly on the streets as French sort of digest the shock that they've had last week.
All right. Thank you very much, Lisa. That is Lisa Bryant reporting from Paris. In a keynote address at the Center for International and Strategic Studies here in Washington, John Brennan, director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, called for vigilance against the emerging external operations agenda of the Islamic State. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy has details.
The top official in the U.S. intelligence community stressed the fact that the terrorist group is changing and no longer limiting its killing fields to Iraqi and Syrian lands or setting up local franchises in other countries, but is extending its reach to the outside world.
ISIL has developed an external operations agenda that is now implementing with lethal effect. But let me note that the grave threat posed by the phenomenon of ISIL makes it absolutely imperative that the international community urgently commit to achieving an even greater and unprecedented level of cooperation, collaboration, information sharing, and joint action in intelligence, in law enforcement, in military operations, and in diplomatic channels. The ISIL threat demands it.
Brennan noted that the horrific attacks in Paris clearly indicated that ISIL's external agenda involved deliberate planning for several months. He cited a string of external operations, including suicide attacks in Beirut and probably the downing of a Russian airliner over Sinai, killing all 224 passengers aboard, and then the Paris tragedy.
And while we await confirmation of culpability for those tragedies, they each bear the hallmarks of terrorism carried out by the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, or ISIL, an organization of murderous sociopaths that carries out its criminal and morally depraved actions under bogus religious pretense.
Brennan acknowledged that Washington and Moscow have significant policy differences on how best to bring the bloodshed in Syria to a close. Nevertheless, there are contacts lately to enhance the cooperation between the two countries on the ISIL threat. CIA director said the world has become more unstable in the past 3 years than in any time since the collapse of the Soviet Union. He concluded that the U.S. should be vigilant because more attacks could be in the pipeline, but he rejected calls to seal the borders or restrict freedoms. Mohammed Shenawi for the International Edition.
Well, meanwhile, French police are seeking 26-year-old Belgian-born Salah Abdeslam, who is believed to have been one of the organizers, along with two of his brothers. Benjamin Haddad is a research fellow and European analyst with the Washington-based Hudson Institute. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Europe has become the new front in the Syrian civil war.
We've seen this already with the flow of refugees that were fleeing the conflict in Syria. And now what happened in Paris is a new consequence of the situation in the Middle East. And we still need to have more information about the origins and the training. It appears that one of the terrorists who have been identified by the French police as a French citizen has trained in Syria in the winter of 2013-2014, and that this operation might have been planned from Syrian territory with the leadership of ISIS to expand the front in Europe.
With the migrant crisis now in full flower in Europe, what is it going to do for those who are trying to welcome these refugees and migrants?
There is a risk of a political backlash against the refugees, which I think would be very troubling because it would represent, I think, a real confusion with what is going on. A lot of these people are fleeing repression. They're fleeing exactly what's been happening in Paris these last few days: violence, terrorism, radicalism. There's been a Syrian passport that apparently belonged to a refugee that's been found next to the body of one of the suicide bombers. It's still very unclear at this point if this is a real passport or not. And there is a risk of rising populism and xenophobia in Europe after these attacks. And I think this is something that European leadership should be very vigilant about.
At the G20 summit in Turkey, world leaders vowed on Sunday a vigorous response to the terrorist attacks in Paris. Of course, as you know, French jets went after IS headquarters in Raqqa in Syria. Will there be a newfound unity in fighting Islamic State?
I mean, it's true that the French authorities privately say that they consider that the United States has taken the back seat on everything that's been going on in Syria. The French have had a very strong position on the ouster of Assad as the only possible solution to the Syrian crisis from the start. Strikes in Syria to prevent potential terrorist attacks against the French territory already this summer. But I think now there's going to be a willingness from European countries and hopefully from the United States to ramp up the fight against ISIS in certain territories. The risk, if the U.S. doesn't take the lead on this, is that European leaders will be more and more pressured to side with Russia, which appears to offer the only solution, which would be a catastrophe both for the transatlantic relation, but also for the situation in Syria, where saving Assad cannot possibly be a political solution to what's happening. I mean, that's the only offer and alternative that the Russians offer.
Well, Ben, of course, France has imposed a state of emergency, apparently the first in many decades. Has France turned a page in the fight against terrorism with this attack in Paris?
It certainly is a new phase of the war on terrorism in France. Now, this isn't new for the last few years, especially with the question of French citizens going to fight alongside jihadis in Syria. The French have ramped up intelligence services, more and more money, means, and recruitment have been focused on intelligence and security services in France. Obviously, we had the Charlie Hebdo attacks just 10 months ago. So this has been a concern of French authorities recently. But I think now, clearly, this has become the defining issue of the Hollande presidency.
That's Benjamin Haddad of the Hudson Institute. As the international search for those behind the Paris terror attacks expands, investigators are increasingly trying to figure out how the terrorists were able to communicate and coordinate the assaults. Now a number of investigators are pointing the finger at an unlikely target, an electronic gaming system made by Sony. International Edition's Doug Bernard covers cyber issues for us and joins me now. Doug, help us understand what's happening here.
Well, first off, before one discounts it, because it seems like sort of a nutty idea almost, consider that as recently as 2013, in documents that were leaked by Edward Snowden, the NSA was already, and the CIA, were already looking at these gaming platforms as a way to that terrorists were using to communicate with each other. Now, let's take a quick look at PS4, which has directly been implicated. It stands for PlayStation 4. It's manufactured by Sony, and it has about 110 million users around the world. Now, what happens when, for those not familiar with these gaming consoles, they're all connected via the Sony network, basically via the internet. They all can kind of connect with each other. So you can play games with people who are sitting next to you on the couch or maybe, you know, 1,000 miles away, all in real time. So these devices are built as a means to connect. It's just that for a long time, I think people have been thinking about, well, my emails are being monitored, my cell phone might be monitored. But these systems are very, very difficult to monitor.
Why are they so difficult to monitor?
Well, first off, you can communicate several different ways. You can send each other text messages, if you want, over this PlayStation network. And it is not known, actually, if the NSA or CIA or other intelligence services actually know how to penetrate this unique Sony network to monitor text communications. But that would probably be the easiest thing to monitor. Consider, however, that when you're playing a game, you can talk with people live. So you and I could be separated by hundreds and hundreds of miles, and yet we would be able to talk with each other live in the game. All those communications are what they call voice over internet protocol, VoIP. And basically, those are all encrypted communications. So even if you could break into the system, you couldn't actually monitor what those live, you know, real-time conversations were. There's one other way that people could communicate. You're doing things in these games, right? Well, let's say you and maybe two or three other people are playing a game, and you have your character go and write something on a wall, say, for example, which is, you know, a communication about, say, maybe planning an attack or something. Well, game to game, that text just simply vanishes. So you and the people playing the game could communicate instantly, and yet any evidence of it would just simply vanish.
So there's no record.
There's no record.
Wow, that's amazing. Thanks very much. That's International Edition's Doug Bernard. A Muslim woman in the Middle East is getting attention on social media for a handwritten note that she posted about the Paris attacks. Michael Lippin joins me now for a look at that. Michael, what's this letter about?
Hi, Sarah. Well, the letter we're talking about was posted on Twitter by a user who goes by the name Tech with the handle at Mena Hafez underscore. She says she's based in Dubai and Cairo and has 500 followers. But you know, the handwritten note that she tweeted a photo of 2 days ago has reached far more people than that. In the letter, the writer identifies as a Muslim, and she quotes a verse from the Quran or Muslim holy book saying, "If anyone killed an innocent person, it would be as if he killed the whole of mankind." Now, many Muslims around the world have been citing that line to make the point that their religion abhors the kind of violence that we saw in Paris. The letter also says, "If a few cowards with beards on their faces kill innocent people and say they are following Islam, they're liars." And the writer ends by saying, "Muslims want peace." Well, the image of that letter has been retweeted 6,000 times and liked 6,000 times as well. It also drew lots of comments. Some Twitter users took issue with the letter, saying other parts of the Quran justify acts of violence by Muslim extremists. And some users responded to those statements by saying people shouldn't blame an entire religion for the acts of extremists. Sarah?
Thank you, Michael. That's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Winter, when days are short, will soon be upon those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. It's the short days that can play havoc with people's moods and well-being. Over 14 million Americans suffer from a form of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. While experts aren't really sure what causes SAD, some think it may be caused by a lack of sunlight in the winter. To treat SAD, some doctors and mental health experts have prescribed light therapy, where patients are exposed to very bright artificial light for 30 minutes or more each day. But a new study has found that cognitive behavioral therapy was much better at preventing SAD patients from relapsing in future winters than light therapy. The study shows that this special form of talk therapy teaches SAD patients to challenge their negative thoughts about dark winter months and resist behaviors like social isolation that can affect a person's mood. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. A new TV series from Amazon, The Man in the High Castle, takes viewers into a world where the Axis powers won World War II and have conquered the United States. International Edition's David Byrd takes a look at the series, a somewhat dystopian view of life under Nazi and Japanese occupation.
The Man in the High Castle is based on Philip K. Dick's 1962 novel of the same name and takes place in 1962. The Allies have lost World War II, and the United States is divided between the Nazis in the East and the Japanese Empire in the West, with a neutral zone between them. Juliana Crane lives in San Francisco, outwardly happy with Japanese rule. But when her half-sister Trudy is killed by the Kempeitai, Japan's equivalent of the SS, Juliana learns that what she thinks she knows might not be true. Before she dies, Trudy hands Juliana a film which contains newsreels of a different outcome, with the Allies winning World War II. Juliana thinks that perhaps the film shows the real world rather than the one in which she lives. Trudy was part of an American resistance and was carrying the film to the neutral zone to meet someone. Juliana decides to take Trudy's place. Rupert Evans stars as Frank Frink, Juliana's boyfriend and a Jew in Nazi-occupied New York.
Frank, I saw Trudy.
What?
I was in the market and I saw her.
You saw the pawns shoot her?
I know it sounds crazy, but I saw her.
Jules, we have to get out of here. The Kempeitai came to the factory today looking for the shooter.
Do you think they were looking for you?
Yeah, told me they didn't ask for anyone by name. I got out before they saw me. Look, the Kempeitai won't let this go until they've got someone.
Okay.
And now, with Arnold, Jules, I have to get out of here. And when they come looking for me, you can't be here either.
French-born American actress Alexa DeValos plays Juliana. She says that while some Americans might balk at the show's premise, it does touch on universal themes.
This takes you away from everything you know. And yet,
you know, there's an emotional connection to it. Pain is something that's obviously very timeless, and loss and fear and oppression and fascism and all these things are elements that we have today, unfortunately, and we had when the book was written and prior. So it's relatable, even though it's so incredibly different.
While in Colorado, Juliana meets and falls in love with Joe Blake, a 27-year-old New Yorker who volunteers to help the resistance. But he's really a Nazi double agent looking to infiltrate and betray resistance fighters. Luke Kleintank plays Joe Blake. He says that viewers might have difficulty accepting the show's premise, but will also find it intriguing.
You know, it's chilling. I think they're gonna have a hard time accepting it. But at the same time, I think they're gonna be intrigued by it. I mean, it's a piece of history that could have happened.
Frank Spotnitz is the show's producer, writer, and creator. He says that making the series reminded him of the huge debt the modern world owes to the World War II generation.
And what I've thought a lot about since embarking on this series is the sacrifices that this generation should be making to ensure that we live in a just world and that we live up to the ideals that, you know, our civilization stands for.
The Man in the High Castle also stars Rufus Sewell as John Smith, a ruthless Nazi SS officer. The Man in the High Castle is available to Amazon Prime subscribers beginning November 20th. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What drives people, especially young men and women, to join brutal and exploitative terrorist groups like ISIL or Boko Haram? We must better understand these drivers if we are to counteract the ability of terrorists to recruit new members and prevent the formation of similar groups in the future. Individuals, even entire communities, may align with violent extremist groups for many complex reasons. Those who feel marginalized by society on the basis of politics, religious convictions, social or economic status, or other grievances may find terrorist propaganda persuasive and look to find meaning and acceptance within terrorist groups, which often provide a storyline that allows them to turn violence and inflicted on the society that had not fully accepted them. On a higher level, individuals and communities may seek meaning in radical ideologies and those who espouse them that seem to meet their needs for a purpose or identity. This means that in order to blunt the appeal of violent terrorist groups, we must find ways to fill unmet human needs. These can range from providing security to expanding economic options to giving marginalized communities a greater stake in determining their political future, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights Sarah Sewell. So we are increasing our work toward an approach to countering violent extremism that better prevents individuals and communities from wanting to align with terrorism in the first place. This includes building trust. It includes empowering a broader range of people, including civil society, businesses, religious leaders, women, youth, international bodies, and former violent extremists to counter the false promises of groups such as ISIL and build more resilient communities. And it involves building a network of global partners, including regional and multilateral institutions such as the Arab League, United Nations, World Bank, African Union, and World Economic Forum, to reinforce the civilian-led components of this approach. In short, if we can remove or lessen the most insistent factors that motivate people to turn toward violence, then we can start replacing destructive ideas that uphold terrorism as a means of change with an avenue toward individual and community improvement and hope for a better future. As President Barack Obama said, "Ideologies are not defeated with guns. They're defeated by better ideas, a more attractive and compelling vision."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.